My word. A panel game devised by Tony Schreyan and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Powell and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton in a game about words. And here's your chairman, Jack Longland.
And we go straight into the first round, which tests their vocabulary. For 2 marks, what's the dictionary meaning of the following words? And we begin with Dennis Norton, and yours is, Dennis, a homophone, H-O-M-O-P-H-O-N-E, homophone.
Homophone, yes. Well, but as you gather from the sniggers in the audience, it has a gay ring to it. It's to do with words, that. It's the opposite of antiphon in antiphonal or so. Homophones are 2 words that sound the same, but are generally spelt differently, and only have different... For example, if you said he was on the beer... it's much more enjoyable if he was on the BWR than on the BIER.
That's as neat a definition of homophones I've heard, Dennis. They sound just alike, but they can differ and do differ in meaning or derivation or spelling. And it's the opposite, therefore, of synonym, exactly the opposite. 2 marks. Dennis Power, casuistry.
Casuistry, that's... It's not quite a straight word, not quite a straight answer.
But full marks.
Full marks, yes, yes. Casuistry means cheating a little bit. It's a theory.
By derivation, it does mean that, Dennis, but not originally.
Originally?
No.
Casuistry. It's a theological word.
It is.
Theological word.
Jesuitical, isn't it?
Jesuitical.
It comes there.
That's good. Jesuitical. We're doing well.
Is it arguing sort of scholastic theology as against theological theology? In other words, the point is the argument and not good theology.
It could be that too, but...
Well, that's enough.
Yes, but, all right, I'll help you a little. Is it arguing from the general to the particular or from the particular to the general?
Should we toss a coin?
It's 50%.
From the general to the particular.
You're absolutely right. You'll get your 2 marks. I think we just creep home there. It's the science or art of resolving cases of conscience by applying general rules of religion and ethics. It ought to be an ethical process, and originally was, but then it gets a bit deteriorated and can be applied to a quibbling or self-excusing evasion of duty or what you ought to do. 2 marks. Frank Mill, ineffable.
Well, it's one of those words, isn't it? Mm. Ineffable. Which doesn't, I think, mean what it sounds like.
Not quite.
Well, it sounds rather insouciant, doesn't it? One thinks of Bertie Wooster as being ineffable. But it's not it, is it?
Yep.
It's to do, with a word like physical... Mm-hmm. With PH. You've got to spell it with the word with PH. It's ineffable. No, that's not it.
Nice, but won't do.
It's quite unspeakable.
See
how that gets. What that gets.
We, not the royal we, but Dill and me.
Yes.
Dill, in fact,
could thinks
it could be unspeakable.
It could be exactly that. And if you'd like to rest...
Thank you, my dear.
If you'd like to rest on your laurels at that moment, I'll give you your 2 marks.
There's a hymn, isn't there?
Ineffable,
God only wise.
God only wise, that's right. It's what cannot be expressed in words, and often in the sense of too great for words, and that's why you find it in a hymn. But it can be unspeakable in another sense, and unutterable. And if you remember, the Victorians, when they couldn't even look at a chair leg without covering it up with muslin, they referred to men's trousers, gentlemen's trousers, as ineffables. Anne Scott-Jones, your turn. an idiosyncrasy?
Well, when Frank Muir gets onto the platform, the first thing he does is take off his tie. And when Dennis Norden tells his story, he always strokes his upper lip with his forefinger.
Oh.
I would have said these were idiosyncrasies, or rather peculiar little personal tricks of behaviour.
Absolutely right. 2 marks. Well, we come to the point in which I give Frank and Dennis a quotation to think about for their stories in the last round. And Frank, yours is, "Kind hearts are more than coronets." And for you, Dennis, "One man's meat is another man's poison." Round 2 is American. It's about American aphorisms. Statements, sometimes provocative, sometimes profound, sometimes pretty puerile, made by fairly well-known Americans. For 2 marks, who said the following? Dennis Norden, "When a great number of people are unable to find work, unemployment results."
Well, this particular man was well known for this kind of statement. He also said, "A business will either get better or worse." He was Calvin Coolidge, who I don't think was such a fool as his statements make out. I remember that another thing he said was something that I think should be borne in mind more over that side of the Atlantic. He said, "The American people expect a solemn ass as their president, and I intend to go along with them." And at least that was a self-confessed solemn ass.
Absolutely right, Dennis. And he was president, and he said this in 1924.
Yeah, he was so taciturn that the man called Wilson Meisner, when the news came through about Coolidge's death, somebody rushed up to him and said, "Coolidge is dead." And Meisner said, "How can they tell?"
Well, there's quite a lot of quotations we shan't be able to use on future programs. Now we go on to Dennis Power. Dennis, "Early to rise and early to bed makes a male healthy and wealthy and dead."
Well, today's sound precept. It was a writer.
Yes.
Bentley.
You're missing it. And think of large and crummy-looking dogs.
Oh! I can't
think of
his name.
Thurber.
Yes.
James Thurber.
It is James Thurber in Fables for Our Time, and I'll give you 1 out of 2. It helped a lot.
I think one of the nicest things he said was, "A woman's place is in the wrong."
That's what I was trying to lead you towards. Now it's Frank Muir's turn. "Familiarity breeds contempt and children."
It's one of these sort of semi-funny, semi-witty things that used to be in the Saturday Evening Post. A chap called Richard Armour used to write them.
I think you're not going back quite far enough.
It's an American... There were dozens of really rather good American humorists around about the turn of the century. Right.
Yes.
Mark Twain?
Yes. Mark Twain in Notebooks. Familiarity breeds contempt and children.
Wait a minute. He said familiarity breeds contempt, which is why we respect truth. Because we're never near enough to it to be familiar with it.
Yes. I can't remember which one that was. But, no, fair enough. 2 more. Anne Scott James, "History is bunk."
Oh, actually, I can do that one. I've been dreading this round because I haven't known anybody else's answers. It was Henry Ford.
1, 2, or 3?
1, I would have thought.
Thank you.
Do you know where he said it, Jack?
Yes, I do, in fact.
Let's try that.
He was prosecuting the Chicago Tribune in a libel action, and I can't remember what the actual question was from which this remark was elucidated, but it was in the middle of a trial in a courthouse in 1919.
Thank you. I've traced that for about 3 months.
Yeah, well, there it is. Well, now we have a round of vocational, V-O, vocational verbs. For 1 mark, to the language of what calling or profession do the following verbs properly belong? And for another mark, can you tell me what any one of the verbs, which I'm about to pronounce, actually means? Dennis Norton. To auscultate, to marsupialize, to phlebotomize. I'll spell them if you absolutely require me, but otherwise I'll leave it to you.
They're all medical.
They're all medical, yes. Try one of
the things that doctors do.
Yes.
And they auscultate with their stethoscope, I believe, yeah?
And what are they doing when they're doing that?
I never know. And I prefer not to ask. Phlebotomize is a sort of transplant surgery on insects, actually. It's an exchange of rear ends among insects. I don't know what's the matter, marsupialize?
Marsupial is something to do with a pouched animal, isn't it?
That's right.
It must be one of those cosmetic surgeries that they do on ladies with under the eyes.
That's a good answer.
They have to be to demarsupialize.
Demarsupialize, yes.
Perhaps it's.
You can get them all. I mean, it's all right.
Oh, I see. We've got a few, haven't we?
That's right. It is. They're all words from the medical profession. Auscultate, listening with ear or with a stethoscope. Usually at how your lungs or your heart are working. Marsupialize means actually to furnish with a bag or a pouch, which is a very rare thing to do. Phlebotomize is to let blood by opening a vein. Now, Dillis Powell, to reach, to jibe, to veer.
If you do the last three together, you can spell the first one rich.
Yeah, it's a turf. Sailing.
Sailing is right.
Sailing.
Can you explain what any one of them is?
Veer, I should think, ought to mean to turn somewhere.
It does?
To move the sails so that while the people on deck fall overboard, the ship turns, well, perhaps not turtle, but anyhow, in an opposite direction.
They fall overboard when you jibe, actually, which means you turn when you're tacking into wind, mm-hmm. and the boom comes across like a sword. And knocks everybody into the water.
You'll get your two marks, but would you like to hazard a guess as you had a good shot at it, Dillis? In veering, as you said, changing direction, are you changing it clockwise or anticlockwise?
Well, it rather depends on the person who's controlling the ship.
All right,
not me.
I won't ask any more. To veer is normally to change direction clockwise, or of a rope. Of course, it means just to slacken it or let it out. To reach is to sail on one tack or to sail with the wind on the beam. To jibe, to turn a boat from one quarter to another so that the sail swings over from one side of the ship or boat to the other. Seamanship. Frank Muir. To traverse, to confess and avoid, to pray at Thales, T-A-L-E-S, but Thales, profession.
Law.
Yes, got right.
Confess and avoid.
Yes.
Well, presumably if you confess, you avoid some steeper punishment.
It could happen. It isn't quite what it means in a technical legal sense.
I'm sure it isn't. What was the one about Thales?
To pray a Thales.
To pray...
Pray
a Thales. A Thales. You have lack of poof.
I have lack of people to sit in that funny little box.
You're dejured. You're dejuro absenteeism.
Well, yes, that's right. And how do you fill up the difference?
Well, you send the press gang out and...
out how far?
Come on, lads. Oh, only as county boundaries. You can't take a jury. It's not legal. This is within the county.
I've done my best. I'm going to give you 1.5. It means to fill up a deficiency in the number of jurymen, and you plead that the number of jurymen should be completed by swearing in any unfortunate citizens who happen to be there in court in order to make up the number. That's to pray at Thales. To traverse is QC, counsel, who is denying something in pleading his opponent's in a pleading of his opponent's case. And to confess and void means to admit, but to admit with justification. So you probably will get all. And Scott Jones. To block out, to black out, to buck and wing.
To block out, to black out, to buck and what?
Wing, like a bird.
Buck and wing.
Go on, Dennis.
Sort of. I think they're all theatrical.
Yes, got it.
Ooh.
A back and wing is it's a weird kind of syncopated step that people used to use for exits in variety. blackout is when all the lights go out on the stage, and you block out a scene when you do a first rehearsal of it, and you do a sort of preparatory try at the moves.
The placing of the players.
Mm. Well, perhaps it's also what the leading lady does, which is determined that a rather prettier extra should not be visible from the stage. She blocks her out.
I think that's all dead right. Buck and wing, in my definition here, is to dance by hopping on one leg and kicking the other outwards while shaking the leg from the knee, which seems to me the can-can, isn't it, Dennis?
No.
Not that. That shows how ignorant I am.
Were this television, Dennis would demonstrate. Thank heavens it isn't.
Anyway, 2 marks. Well, now we come to the last round. And we go back to those quotations I gave Frank and Dennis at the beginning of the programme. For this round, the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And if you remember, Frank, your quotation is, "Kind hearts are more than coronets," which comes from Tennyson and, I think, Lady Verdivere.
The most extraordinary coincidence, you know, which helps make this programme so leaden, is that only a few weeks ago I was recited this proverb in Creole, in the island of Mauritius. And in Creole it goes, "Tout la casa, la pied, milatres, do dili bado." And in fact it was sung. It was sung to me by a small Creole lad, age 14, who was trying to flog shells on the beach. His name, inexplicably, was Clarence. The skull of that. And he goes, "To la casa la pia mia tresto dearly bado." And that quotation. Most extraordinary. I didn't want any shells because they're sort of rather ugly. Those shells. He wouldn't be put off. He's going to go farther, is Clarence, I might say. No worries with him. He'll survive. He said, "No shells, you like pawpaw? What do you like? Pineapple? I shred it for you. You like to see the trees, the ebony trees? I take you to the pamplemousse gardens. Where you like to go, I find." And I said, no. This is really nothing. And I had a thought. There was some way of using Clarence. I should explain at this point what my wife and I were doing on Mauritius a few weeks ago. Well, we went there because my wife was born there and hadn't been back for 37 years. And we decided that it was time she went back just to make sure that she turned the gas off. It was also our anniversary of our silver wedding, so we were having a holiday there. And it's a magnificent, marvellous island, Mauritius. It is tremendously beautiful, and the people there are not only extremely beautiful, but the pleasantest people I've ever met anywhere in the world. The only trouble is, coming back, is the photographic record. You know, I like to always like to pore over the photographs afterwards, and very little of what was sort of real Mauritius seemed to me to be photographed. And I was dying to get a record, and I said to my wife, "Now, what is really indigenous about Mauritius? What do you remember that we should see?" And she said, "I remember that." The little old men, aged about 104, used to sort of hunker down on street corners and have little bowls of nuts around them. They were peanuts, and some of them were shelled, and they're painted bright pink and bright blue. And you grind them up, and you put them beside the curry, the dish of curry. It's one of the side dishes of curry, and that'll make a marvellous picture. I said, "Fine." And so the other thing I remember, in the plantations, the huts nowadays are sort of corrugated iron and concrete, in fact, concrete villas. But the old plantation workers' huts used to be made of bamboo cane strung together with sort of plaited roofs. And said, "If you could get a photograph of those." So I turned to Clarence, my little lad, and said, "Right, find me a little old man selling these coloured peanuts. How much will you charge? I want two of them." He said, "One little piece, sir." I said, "Fine, worth very reasonable." "Right, and find me two huts made of bamboo cane. And here's a 5-rupee note, bring me the change." So he came back and he gave me the addresses of these things. And I said, "Where's the change?" He said, "No change." I said, "No, wait a minute, lad, Clarence. Wait a minute. You said 1 rupee each for finding these men with the nuts." He said, "Oh, yes, sir, but we have a saying in our country. In Creole, it goes, To la casla pia milatres to dia libardo. I said, what does that mean in English? And he said, cane hats are more than curry nuts.
And we pass on to Dennis Norden, and if you remember, his quotation was, one man's meat is another man's poison, which is a pretty old proverb.
Well, back here in England, there was only one occasion in my life when I put myself on a really strict diet for any length of time. And I can tell you from the heart, it was the most miserable afternoon I ever spent. It was a Sunday, actually. Every detail of it is etched on my nervous system. Because I didn't get up that Sunday till about midday due to the fact that I'd been sleeping with Lady Pamela. Now, I should explain to you, because of the awe that aroused, that Lady Pamela was a bitch. She was a Doberman pincher bitch, actually, and she didn't belong to us. She belonged to the rather trendy couple who lived next door, who they'd asked us if we'd look after her for that Saturday night, because they wanted to go to a big fancy dress wife-swapping party that was being held down the road in aid of the Wildlife Fund. Now, I don't know how much you know about Doberman pinchers, but I assure you it couldn't be less than I do. But this one, for all her enormous size, was of such absolutely surpassing cowardice, ineffable cowardice, that she wouldn't sleep by herself. We tried putting her down in the kitchen, but every time the fridge switched on, she went into such quivering hysteria, we had to feed her good boys dipped in brandy. So she ended up on our bed on top of it, and even then she got an attack of the moaning trembles when the tea maker went off. But so when I got up at midday, I was really suffering from the red eye specials, and when I got in the bathroom, what made me even more irritable was I suddenly discovered in myself a strange, girlish kind of modesty about undressing in front of a strange dog. It's absolutely absurd, isn't it? But I didn't like to push her out because someone three doors away had switched on a vacuum cleaner and she was carrying on like it was the invasion of the body snatchers. But anyway, I let her hang around the bath and took my bathrobe off and I got on the bathroom scales. And that's why I had this absolutely heart-stopping shock. Since the morning before, I'd put on 16 pounds. 16 pounds I put on overnight action stations. Well, I have a theory about dieting. People will tell you that the worst part about getting weight off is having to watch what you eat. Well, it isn't. The worst part is having to watch what other people eat, right? So what I explain to my family is what will happen is, while I'm not eating, nobody will eat. And that way I will be neither discouraged nor tempted. I tell you what I said to them, we'll call it supportive therapy. Well, look, you know all that stuff you hear on Woman's Hour about the bonds of family loyalty being as strong as ever they were? Lot of nonsense. I didn't get any of it. You know, I'm not sure whether I ever would have had any faith at all in family life again if it hadn't been for my old white-haired mother. She was white-haired. She's blonde now, but she was white-haired. About 5:30, she came over to me and she said, "Son, I've been thinking very hard. Would you do something for me?" And I said, "Anything, Mum. You know, you know that." And she said, "Would you go upstairs and weigh yourself again?" I said, "Well, there's no point." She said, "Please." would you, for me? Well, I did. It was uncanny. When I came down, I said to her, I said, Mother, what was it? What suddenly got rid of those £16? Was it simply the power of mother love? Or was it the concentrated energy of the whole family focusing their thoughts together? She said, none of that. She said, but it was just that this time the dog didn't put his paw on the scale. Well, I still blame the weighing machine manufacturers myself. What kind of technology is it that can't distinguish between the body of a man and the paws of a dog? There is something definitely wrong with a machine where, as the old proverb puts it, one man's meat is a Doberman's paws on.
Ladies and gentlemen, by your vote, Dennis Norden wins the story, and he and Anne Scott James also win the entire contest. And that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland, with questions compiled by Peter Moore. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.